Ephemeral is a production of iHeartRadio.
So Matt and I were talking about bands putting out new music on old formats, mainly tape cassette and vinyl.
We have a new person who's working at our office named Seth. He runs a record company where he specifically will take your music and make a vinyl record out of it. That's what he does.
This guy right here?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Seth Nicholas Johnson's label, Haunted Birthday Records, releases music in a truly unique way, utilizing a format which I knew nothing about. This is how he explained it to me as we hung out in the studio and listened to records. You'll hear from us after this track. So who is that?
That was a guy named Elias Mason, and he made that song with his creative partner, June York. And this was a little A-side, B-side single with Swoon on one side and Diamonds on the B-side. So there we go.
Swoon on one side and Diamonds on the B-side. Yeah. That was Swoon.
This one was Diamonds.
This was Diamonds. Yeah. This was the B-side.
Yes.
Okay, so Seth, just what the heck is it that you do exactly?
Mostly what I do is I run a record label, and in today's world, we live in 2019, running a record label doesn't really mean what it used to mean a billion years ago, right? Like, people don't need record labels in the same way they used to need them back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, even the 90s. Around when people could start to self-distribute with any kind of, like, reliability of like, hey, I can actually just put my album out there. People can actually find it. And then I can actually make money from it. Once that started to happen, I think the world became a much better place. But record labels needed another reason to exist. So the only reason I could find to actually maintain my reason for wanting to have a record label and actually making myself be a company was that I needed to make sure I could provide something to bands, something they couldn't get other places. And the thing I decided, just because I enjoy it, was to start making a very specific kind of vinyl for people who want it, and to let people have this product that I'm making.
So I only know a little bit about it. Pretend I know nothing about it.
Sure.
What is this thing?
Specifically, these are lathe embossed records. So I'll spell it out in a very broad sense.
Great.
Anyone who's listening who knows like the depths of all the audiophile stuff will correct me on everything, but I'm just going to like spell it out in like real simple terms.
Cool.
When it comes to creating records, and I'm talking about just like the standard records you buy in a store, like a vinyl record, there are basically three ways to make it. The most common way is you basically stamp them. It's like you get two like negatives of the record, negative side A, negative side B, and think about like a waffle iron. You know, you just like put in the stuff, squish it together. Boom, out comes your record, right? That's the standard way to do it. The other two ways, one is called lathe cutting and one is called lathe embossing. So you know what a lathe is, right? Like in like a wood shop, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So for our listeners, if anyone doesn't know what a lathe is, basically it's just like a rotating tool. That's all there is to it. So the way that a lathe embosser and a lathe cutter works is that there's a record cutting head with a little stylus on the bottom that's moving at a very precise, very exact, very steady speed, and like an x-axis, like across a blank record. And the stylus, the actual like needle, for lack of a better term, is vibrating with the music that you're putting into
it.
And then that is either cutting a groove or embossing a groove into this piece of plastic, this piece of acetate, this piece of polycarbonate or whatever. People make stuff out of chocolate, ice, cardboard, anything you want.
Well, I've got it written down here. What all can you make a record out of?
So many. I mean, to be completely honest, anything. The big question is what's going to sound good, you know? Like I've heard an ice record and it sounds kind of garbage.
How, okay. Well, so where did you hear an ice record?
There was a band, I believe it was the Shout Out Louds. I hope I'm getting that correct, but I'm 99% sure I am. And what they did is they made to release their new single, they released a silicone? Which one is it?
rubbery stuff?
Yeah, the rubbery
silicone.
Stuff. Silicone. Silicone or silicon?
No, silicon.
Silicon
chips.
Valley.
Yeah.
Silicone is the rubber.
Yeah.
Okay. So it was a silicone.
You could do a silicon record but it'd be very expensive, I think.
But the silicone was for like the almost like an ice tray, okay?
Right.
And so you filled it with water, and they recommended that you used like a nice, like distilled, as clear as possible water so you don't get any, you know, little bumps and stuff.
No tap water.
Yeah. And you freeze it. And then you put it on your record player, and it worked exactly like an ice cube. That's exactly what it was.
Oh, so that, again, was just the negative imprint.
Yes.
Was it only on one side of the?
Correct.
So you would just like sort of, it would be like making the B side, I guess. The underside, and it's what's the right term for that? I mean, it's raised, I guess, in the tray.
Exactly. Inside the mold, it would be raised, and then you fill it, and then the grooves would be there, and then you would pop it onto your record player.
On your regular record player.
That's the most dangerous part. Yeah,
in a walk-in freezer or something.
You got to be careful with that part. I mean, because it's going to start dripping. You got to play it once and get rid of it.
so you said you heard one played.
Yes.
How did it sound?
Not very good.
Still so cool.
It is. Like that's the fun of analog music, is that it feels like a magic trick, you know? Like, and that's kind of like the guy who trained me. There's this guy out in Tucson, Arizona. His name is Michael Dixon, and he runs a record label called Piaptic Records. And
right, spell it because it's a weird spelling.
Piaptic?
Yeah.
P-I-A-P-T-K. It stands for people in a position to know.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
We'll have to link it. Yeah,
and he's a fantastic dude, and he trained me everything I know. I learned from him, basically, other than like the things I've you know, gleaned other places. But yeah, that's like where I got my machine was from this dude. Whenever I need like new styluses for my machine, I have to like write to him to get them. Like he's my connection.
I want to talk more about all the things that records are made of, but let me back all the – so there's three kinds of ways to make a record.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
Yours
– lathe embossed.
Is the embossed. What's the difference between the embossed and the other kind of lathe?
Lathe cut.
Yeah. What's the difference between the cut and the embossed?
Think about a muddy field, okay?
Great.
Okay.
I'm there.
And you are carrying a stick in your hand, all right? And you're walking and you're dragging the stick behind you in this muddy field. So you're not actually getting rid of any of that mud. You're just creating a groove from where your stick is dragging. So all the, I guess, excess mud is just kind of slightly going out and maybe creating slight ridges mm-hmm. along the edge, right? So that's embossing. You're not removing any material from the actual physical blank record. You're just slightly pushing it away. Oh. And so every once in a while, the fascinating thing about that is that so it creates these things that are referred to as horns.
Horns.
And so what it is every once in a while on a lathe embossed record, when you drop the needle on, it won't land in the groove. It'll land on the horns. And it'll sound like it's broken and terrible. And so that's fun too.
So if you go to a regular music store and you buy a record, mm-hmm.
It's usually a pressed record.
A pressed record.
Yes,
oh, okay.
Yes.
So that's pouring what, vinyl in or something?
Yeah. It's standard vinyl. I believe it's, science word, like, you know, yeah. Polyvinyl chloride or something. And if you go to a factory, you'll see them. They come in what are called either biscuits or pucks. And it looks just like kind of like a little hockey puck, mm-hmm. that shape of like soft poly. Vinyl chloride, I'll pretend. And it looks just like a waffle maker. Just presses it down, opens up, pull out your record.
And that's the most economic way to make a bunch of Bee Gees records.
Yes, but that's the problem. From what you just said, and that also explains why I do this entirely, which is if you go to a standard record manufacturer and you say, hey, I would like a record made, please. They go, great. And you go, I need 150. They go, no. Like the cost to make one record in an actual plant, right, actually manufacturing the plates and stamping it, is so big that you can't do it in small batches. You have to most places have a minimum of 300 records and a wait of about 3 months to get your records.
What does it cost to get 300 records done at a place like that?
Whole lot. Like in all honesty, our prices per record are actually pretty comparable. Because it's actually pretty expensive still to make physical records, no matter who you are and at what level you're doing it.
Oh, interesting.
So our prices are actually pretty similar. The differences are that they only have to do it once. Whereas if I'm doing, since I'm using my machine, my plastic, and going through the motions, if someone orders 15 records from me, I'm doing them at 1x speed 15 times.
Right, so take me through that step by step.
Sure.
Make a record
totally.
in your mind here.
Totally. And this is the way that I do it, the lathe embossing.
Yeah.
You got it.
That's what you're here for. That's what you're an expert on.
Totally. So what I'll do is first I call up my plastic manufacturer and I order a whole bunch of polycarbonate. Polycarbonate is basically plexiglass. It's used for eyeglass lenses. It's used for bulletproof glass. It's used for, you know, all that transparent plastic glass substitute, that's polycarbonate. Through trial and error, all of the people who have done this over the years have discovered that that's what works best for this system. Is because you can do this onto, like I said, almost any surface. People have done it onto like picnic plates or like just anything, any surface you can imagine, you can do it into it, but it just might not sound very good. So polycarbonate is the easiest to get, sounds pretty good, and it's also just like very, it's malleable, it's easy to acquire, it's common, you know? Mm. So I contact my plastics manufacturer, and depending upon what size I need, if I'm making 7-inch records or 12-inch records, I'll be like, hey, I need 12-inch records. They come in these like sheets. I'm like, hey, can you cut these into 12-inch squares for me? They go, sure thing. Zip, zip, zip. I drive out to my place. That's OTP, you know, in Alpharetta or something. Pick up my records and then pick up my squares of plastic, bring them back home. And then the next step is I need to cut them into a circle because a 12-inch square will not fit on a record player because the actual sides will run into the edges again and again. So I need to cut it into a circle. So I have a, I believe it's, it's a router, a circle router, where I put a circle jig on it and go bzzz, cut into a circle. Then I have a drill press where I'll drill the hole in the middle of the record into it, zoop, zoop. And then there we are. We have a just plain blank plastic circle. I then go to my machine. And these machines are very odd. They are leftovers from the radio era. Like, and I'm talking like 1930s radio era. So pretty much all of the lathe, the homemade lathe machines in the world are all about 100 years old at this point.
Wow. Yeah. I didn't know that at all.
Because they're all just leftover parts. No one manufactures machines for this anymore. So most people in this field and in this hobby, I suppose, use a machine called a Presto 6N. That is horribly uninteresting to most people, but that is the exact kind.
Is that what you have, a Presto 6N?
I'm fancy. So I have a Presto 88G. So,
I see.
There's not much of a difference. The only difference is like mine is a pretty big console and it is a bit more rigid and rugged, so I don't have to fiddle with it as much. I can do a lot of records with some assurance that it'll work out well. Whereas if you're using a 6N, you have to kind of like check after every single record you make to make sure that it's working still.
Wow.
Because, I mean, if you think about it, like the whole idea of records is based on the idea of vibration. So if your machine is perpetually vibrating for hours on end, all your little adjustments, all of your screws that are tightened, everything that needs to be where it is, it's just subtly shaking itself out of alignment the whole time you're using it. So it can be really annoying.
Yeah, that seems pretty problematic.
Yeah. So these machines, like I said, they are old. So old days of radio, right? So we're talking like Fibber McGee and Molly, you know. Like,
you're talking about whom?
Oh, that's like an older 30s or 40s radio show, Fibber McGee and Molly.
Fibber McGee and Molly?
It was very popular back in the day.
No, I totally believe you. I'm going to have to – that reference went right over my head.
Yeah. I am coincidentally also very into old-time radio. So we can talk about the great Gildersleeve all day. Don't worry about it.
Wow. Okay. We're going to have – I'm going to have to check my references against you. All right. Anyway, in the days of Fibber McGee and Molly.
Yeah. Back then most radio shows back then were made to be played once and often just done live and then over. That's it. They move on to the next one because the concept of reruns wasn't really a thing yet. So apparently, I wasn't there, but apparently one of the things that really spurned on the whole idea of a rerun was World War II, because during World War II, they still wanted to have military radio stations playing like a lot of the shows they played here. But they couldn't like broadcast them like the same intervals and same times because, you know, it's international, blah, blah, blah. So they started actually putting things onto records and they had to figure out a way how to do that. So that's where these Presto 6Ns came in.
Yeah.
Pretty much every single radio station back in the days, let's say the 30s through the 50s, had a Presto record maker in their building amongst all their stuff. And same thing with like a weather report or like a news bulletin or anything. If you just had to have something and then replay it later, that's how you did it. And so that's where these machines came from. And one day someone realized, oh man, you know, I could do something with this. And various people hobbyists just started developing ways to make this all work. So I go up to my machine with my newly made plastic circles, walk up to them, and I take my music source. Now, the music source can be nearly anything. The way I have my system set up at my house is it's just all based on a 1/8-inch outlet. So anything that can be plugged into a 1/8-inch headphone jack, I can put onto a record. And
your iPod.
Yes, exactly. My iPod.
Both are owners. We're current owners of iPods still.
You have to be. I don't have the alternative. I don't know what it could be yet. And then you plug it in, and if you're smart, you would probably master it a little bit before to make sure you're taking full advantage of everything that you're doing. Like I run it through a graphic equalizer, and I have a preamp where I can turn things up and down and all that kind of stuff.
But generally, someone has sent you – I mean, if you're doing work for somebody, somebody has sent you the finished file.
Yes, yes. But even so, let's say the song we heard earlier,
right.
Okay, this person, Elias Mason, would have sent me this song and said, here you go. Here's a song. Please put this on a record, blah, blah, blah. Here's the details. I go, great. I still have to do this thing where it's there's a thing called the RIAA curve,
right.
You know?
Okay.
So I have to invert the RIAA curve in the equalization because the way that we handle music now has almost nothing to do with the way how we used to handle music in the 1930s through the 50s. I mean, because think about things like bass. Bass didn't exist back then. You know what
Not
I mean?
Really, yeah.
Yeah. And then also stereo. Stereo didn't exist
right.
back then. there's all these little things that they had no way of anticipating. And so that's why I specifically make mono lo-fi records. That is my thing. Like with my machine, I could do hi-fi. I could do some stereo stuff if I wanted to. But it's like, no. My goal is to be as attainable as possible to everyone. So therefore, like, I want it to be simple. I want it to be direct. I want it to be pure, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's why my records are coming from a 100-year-old machine that is creating basically the same noises you could hear back then, but just being forced through a modern machine, kind of going through that 100-year-old machine. And then I put the machine on, lower the arm. The cutting stylus, you can use a lot of different gems, basically. I've used, there's so many you can use. Mostly I use Ruby. A Ruby stylus works the best.
Is it actually made out of ruby?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
It's red. It's transparent. It's a full-blown ruby. There's sapphire styluses, too, that work pretty well.
I thought gem was – I didn't know. I didn't realize you meant actual gems.
I mean actual gem. And then if I was doing lathe cutting, let's go back to that that field of mud and you drag in your
Please.
Stick.
Yeah.
Now pretend instead of a stick, you have a shovel. And you are actually removing the dirt and putting it somewhere else, removing it, putting it somewhere else. Then you need a diamond stylus for that.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's for the actual cutting. And when you're cutting it, you'll actually see a ribbon of the acetate, because you also have to use acetate if you're cutting. And you'll see it coming off. And that is the most flammable substance I've ever encountered.
Really?
Yes. Because I also have to treat my plastic right before I cut. You can do a lot of things. You can do turtle wax. You can, me personally, I use lighter fluid. I will take a just standard barbecue lighter fluid, squirt it on top with like a little apothecary bottle, rub it into the plastic to start, it kind of softens it a little bit, makes it a bit more malleable. And that's, then I put on the needle, play the music back in real time, 1x, and that's vibrating my needle, my Ruby stylus. And it moves across the record, and then I put it down, zip, 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 pull it up, pop it off, there we are.
And so that the first one, you've just gotten Elias's mix,
mm-hmm.
and you're cutting the first side of the first record.
Correct.
Does that thing come out to be a coaster?
Oh, yeah. No, the first, I'm going to say on average, the first two or three are coasters. Because it also has a lot to do with actually making it sound good, too. Because mm-hmm. if you can make it just come out, no problem, the first time. But not only does every machine have like its own kind of like quirks when it comes to the machinery, it also has its own quirks when it comes down to just like standard, how does this sound? Does it sound good? You know, like my machine, for example, I know that its sibilance is really hard. Like, right, I'm thinking about my graphic equalizer in my brain, like right here, I got to turn this down.
Like 10,000 hertz, not too high.
Exactly.
No, I'm right. Okay.
Exactly. And then, I got to roll off the low end. There's just like all these like little things that like I know my machine needs. And so I can try to do those things in advance, but you're not going to know how it sounds until you cut one and listen to it, no matter what.
So your process is like you cut one and then you take it off and you just sit there and listen to it?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And then you say, a little less on the 10,000, roll off a little more bass, and you just do another one, you listen to it. And then once you're in a groove, do you keep listening to them one at a time?
So let's say I'm done. I'm happy with it.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, great. I have this side. I am happy. This is good. Here we go. Then I will cut one more with those exact settings to make sure that like, all right, everything is perfectly still doing it again. And I've listened to two in a row, you know, being like, okay, this is replicatable. It's working. Then I will usually go every few. I'll check, just to make sure that it's still moving forward and moving well and nothing's getting in the way and no sound differentials have happened. Because, you know, this isn't playing through a speaker. All I can hear is the subtle vibration noises. It's kind of like when you listen to a record player that isn't hooked up to speakers, where you can still kind of like hear that song, but it's just kind of a weird tinny noise in the background. Mm-hmm. That's more or less what my record machine sounds like when it's cutting, is just... That's what it sounds like. So you have to kind of like just hope that that sound is actually making it all the way through onto the machine itself. So yeah, still every few records, I'll just do a quick needle drop just to make sure it's still working.
Right. Just but, a quality check.
But yeah, then I'll just do that until the order is fulfilled. And usually, like my whole thing is to be obtainable. That's my whole goal, is I want literally every single person who just makes music and wants to put it on a record to do it. So that's why, at my record label, we don't have any minimums. If someone wants to contact me for one record, I gotcha. We'll do this, you know? And so the point of doing that is I have to make sure that all of my goals are aimed towards keeping it as inexpensive as possible, not only for them, but for me as well, because if I don't stay in business, then they definitely don't get anything.
Absolutely.
So let's say there's a B side. So,
right.
So I've cut the A side.
Do you sometimes do ones with just an A side?
Yeah, sometimes. A lot of artists... here, I'll hand you one.
Great.
Here's one. Oops. There we go. That one. Here, you can pull it out. That one's got an engraving on one side.
Oh, wow. This is the actual... I thought this was just like... the cover or something. Oh, wow, that's so cool.
So yeah, that's got an etching on one side of one man shaking another man's hand and it exploding because it came from, I believe, an old like gag catalog of like selling like, you know, novelty gags and whatnot.
Just like traced out from a...
Yeah. Traced out from a book. And so what I did is on one side is a song.
Yeah.
And on the other side... And that's the thing too. I had to just do this again and again and again. I took a little jewel engraver, little like bzzz things, and it just had to draw that, you know, several times until it was done. So that's one reason for
So you cut the record. You had the lathe cut the music.
Yes.
On one side, and then you by hand did this illustration on how many records?
That one, it was definitely in the tens. I'm going to say less than 50, I'll say. and it's
multi- this is a pretty involved, like, there's like...
Here's a couple more,
too. Cross-hatching on the tie of the guy, and there's like, it's a full cartoon here.
Oh, and there's multiple images. This was a series.
So you did a different...
There were multiple versions of each image, but there were also multiple images. Yeah.
So this is what, like a lady and some... Cello, eating some cello, or she's about to, but there's a fly on it.
I would assume this was an advertisement for plastic flies to stick in people's food as a gag.
Oh, right.
In like the 1920s.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's either mashed potatoes or ice cream. I don't know what that could be.
And then this, some like two hands holding cards, some kind of trick deck.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, my gosh.
So yeah.
These are really involved.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a lot of fun. And that's kind of the thing I like about it, too, is that... I'm going to make an analogy for you. You ready?
Please.
Okay. So back in like the old days of, let's go with art in general, writ large art, people start off with like cave paintings, right?
Right.
And they're doing their cave painting things and they're doing what they can with what they know. And they're painting their bison and they're like hunters and there's all, you've seen cave paintings, you know?
Sure.
As they develop, they got closer and closer to actually representing what they actually saw. Like the photorealism, bad choice of words because there were no photos yet, but you know what I mean? Like the actual like representation of what was in real life and what they were creating. So now we're up to like the Renaissance era.
Naturalism, perhaps?
Yeah, exactly. It's like people could actually paint what they saw now because they had acquired enough skills over the ages.
Three-point perspective and
all those techniques,
all the good things,
had made them better and better artists. And then the camera was invented. Mm. And that's when things got interesting. You know what I mean? Because like as soon as the camera was invented, that's when all of the best art, in my opinion, started happening. That's when you got you know, abstract expressionism. That's when you got pointillism. That's when you got all these really cool things because you didn't need to be a replicator of reality. We had that. So now painters got to be whatever they
sort
wanted.
Sort of unlocked everybody to, hurl paint at the giant canvas and things.
Definitely. So I feel that way about the records I do in obviously a very small way. But what I do is like, so artists will come to me and they're like, wait, why mono and why lo-fi? I'm like, well, if you want a perfect reproduction of your sound, you've got it. You've got a WAV file. You've got an MP3.
That will never change.
You got it.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. If you want a perfect replication, we got FLAC lossless all day. And it will never degrade. You're perfect. If you want something else, I gotcha.
Yeah.
I will make an etching onto a thing of a lady with a fly in her mashed potatoes and put your song on the B-side. And it's mostly my main clients are artists that are, I don't want to say unpopular, because I think most artists are unpopular. Like, mm-hmm. I think writ large, if we think about every single artist in every single medium throughout the world, like what, maybe 1% is popular from each genre?
Yeah, maybe. That might be stretching it.
Exactly. Yeah. So I really am for everyone else. And it's funny because, like, I don't know why people don't target that demographic more, because most of us are unpopular. Aim for the unpopular, you know?
Yes.
So my clients are 100% people who are like, wait, you're charging me, I need 300 minimum records in my order? Like, I don't have 300 fans. I can't do that. Most of us don't have 300 fans. That's silly. So that's my audience. My audience is people who just, they need 20, they need 50, whatever. And then they're going to sell them at their shows while they're touring. They're going to a record show. They want to do things. I actually have been getting quite a few very personalized records, which is really nice. Like I've done, people will like record their child's first words like on their iPhone.
Oh, yeah.
And so then they'll want something special to remember that by, because obviously they're just going to, their phone's going to die, their SIM card will get corrupted, and then that memory is gone. So they'll send me that file and be like, hey, can you put my child's first words onto a record? Absolutely. Why not? And then why not do some really cool packaging for it,
too? So what's that one look like? The first word, the person that sent you the first words, what did that record look like?
That one, I was actually, I love that one, because the guy I was dealing with, I guess I won't give his name just in case he wants it to be a secret, but mm-hmm. he is a fantastic artist. Before all this, I don't want to confuse the whole world, but I came into this realm from the world of the fine arts and animation. Like, that's where I've spent all of my life.
Oh, well, it doesn't work so well in the audio format, but these records are like incredibly, I can't believe they're done by hand. But.
Yeah. No, it took a long time. but that's where I come from. So I have a lot of friends in the art world. So this example I'm talking about specifically, a friend of mine, it was a gift for his wife. And
that's so that good job, dude.
Yeah.
And I'm going to steal your idea.
Oh, totally. And so he... he's already a great artist. So I was like, okay, here, I'll decorate the disc for you. And then I'll just send you a white blank sleeve so you can decorate the outside. Mm-hmm. And so I think I've got one around here somewhere. I did just a simple stamp set. Oh, here we go. One of our coworkers, Andrew Howard, is in that band.
Oh, Spooky Booty and the Tombstone Goofs.
Yes.
Yeah, I can believe that Andrew's in that band.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's great.
So I did something kind of similar to that for that one, which is just like hand-stamped, real lo-fi, just looking real simple.
It kind of looks like maybe, a kid did it in, in class or in their church Sunday school project.
Totally.
That's smeared a little bit. The Y is smeared in booty.
Mm-hmm.
Can we play a little bit of this one?
I don't know.
Just play it. I'll cut it out. Let me just hear a little bit of Andrew's band. Is this new?
No. This is really old.
This is really old?
And in fact, let's make sure this may not even be what we think it is. Because one of the things I do often is, let's say I'm making 25 records for someone, right? I make 26. That way, if one gets broken or corrupted or something, then I was like, phew, I don't have to start all over again. I can just give them that extra one and I'll keep the garbage one for myself. So this might be a garbage one.
Okay. I kind of would love to hear what the coasters sound like too.
I was glad that we actually got, what was it, that skip when we played the first time. When we got that one skip,
we both went like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, it was good. So let's see what we got. This one might be a coaster.
Oh, that's great though. I It's Andrew Howard, everybody.
Let's see what else we got in here. Oh. This one's definitely a coaster, but I know who this is. Yeah, this is an artist named Phantom Manor.
Oh, yeah. It's grooving.
But yeah, this is a total garbage version.
It seems like the output volume's kind of low.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Fascinating, fascinating.
Let me look through some more of these records.
Absolutely.
What else is...
I'll hand you a bunch. Here we go.
I know it's a little hard to summarize because there's just like... Like, so this is Knit.
Oh, yes.
And a lot of these are square. These are, so what, give me the specs of this record here.
So that is a 7-inch record. It's 7 inches square. And I like the square because it holds the shape of the packaging a lot better. So for example, the one you're looking at right now, that is a Knit record sleeve. And so because of that, like if you just put a circle inside that exact same packaging, mm-hmm. it would have like these floppy edges.
Right.
You know? So the alternative to that, actually, I'm going to hand it to you.
You could use this as a pot holder afterwards. Oh, yeah. Afterwards, I don't, you put the, just while you're playing the record, I guess. So here you've got like a Knit.
12-inch.
12-inch.
And so...
And the 12-inches have to be circular.
Exactly, or else right. they won't fit on a standard record player.
Right.
But so in that case, I was able to get a little interior sleeve to make sure I hold, you know, the mm-hmm. shape of the actual Knit thingamajigs.
Right, like what you would have in a normal 33.
Exactly.
That's sort of, yeah, paper insert that goes inside of the... record sleeve.
Yeah. And so, yeah, the Knit sleeves are something I do simply because I like to knit.
Oh, my God.
So that's just something I do. And so it just...
How do you find time to do all these things?
I don't know. I love to make things, and I love to stay busy. So, yeah, the Knit album sleeves are really fun because... do you remember that Wu-Tang album a while ago? It was this one a while ago where... do you remember a guy named Martin Shkreli? Huge jerk. He like,
yeah.
He like played up all
how
this.
How did he come up in this? Okay.
Here's
yeah.
how. Here's how.
Yeah.
So a long time ago, I'm going to say, 5 to 6 years ago, maybe even longer than that at this point, there was a Wu-Tang Clan album called Once Upon a Time in Shaolin that they made one and only one copy of, period. And so they made this, they put it out into the world, and they're like, hey, whoever wants to buy this, then they get to do whatever they want with it. Unfortunately, the person that bought that album was Martin Shkreli.
That's what I do remember this story, yeah.
Yes. And so he paid an obscene amount of money for it. He's the one and only owner. Then he got sent to jail for being a jerk. And
he drastically inflated the price on...
AIDS medication.
Yes. What a scumbag.
Absolutely. We don't even need to throw an allegedly in there. He is a scumbag. And so, yeah, now that album is out there in limbo. But anyway, that example I only bring up because I love making one-of-a-kind records, and those Knit ones are that. That, like, okay. Because, I'll be completely honest with you, that little one, the little 7-inch Knit mm-hmm. album, that one is 40 hours to just knit that sleeve. And so because of that, people don't want to pay for that. You know what I mean? Like
right.
people will buy like one copy tops. and then that is kind of the fun of it. Like I do these things probably at least on a quarterly basis called the Haunted Birthday Mystery Record. Oh, I guess I haven't said the name of my company. It's Haunted Birthday Records. So the Haunted Birthday Mystery Record, I make once per quarter, and I contact some artist and I'm like, hey, I'm going to put out one and only one copy of this album ever. Do you want to contribute to it? And artists love to do that.
And it's a compilation with people on your label or?
Pretty much anyone yeah. I can contact. Because
yeah.
I don't tell anyone who's on it. I don't tell them, I honestly mostly give them away. Sometimes I'll sell them. Sometimes I'll hide them places. You know how there's a thing in Atlanta, the Free Art Fridays
sure.
thing? I've given them away for Free Art Fridays before. And yeah, it's just a, it's just a complete mystery. I will never tell someone who's on it. Like there could be just like – I'm going to jump to an extreme to prove a point. But there could be a Beyoncé single that no one's ever heard on one of my Haunted Birthday Mystery records. And that's just the way it is. And I'm never
– Is there a Beyoncé single on one of your
– I can't tell you. but that's kind of the fun of it, is that it could be anyone. And I really enjoy doing that. That's something I do probably quarterly, which is, you know, just for kicks. And that's the other thing that I love about this style of record making, is that the buy-in and the stakes are so low that you can just do art for art's sake and have fun and make dumb things and put them out into the world, because who cares? You know, if I had to make 300 copies of a mystery record, then like I would put some time and energy, because it's an investment of resources and money to actually put out these 300 things into the world. I need to make sure there's enough of an audience for it. I need to make sure that it like appeals to enough people to make sure I'm blah, 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 blah. If I'm only making one copy, it could literally just be farts for like, you know, 5 minutes on each side. And who cares?
Have you done any like sort of large runs, longer runs of what's
sure.
maybe the biggest one that you've done?
I'd say in the hundreds. Yeah. Once people reach 300, that's when I tell them, I'm like, hey, I'm very willing to do this for you, but since you're making this many, you can just contact a regular.
It's going to be cost effective at that point.
Exactly.
You're going to break through.
And also time effective too.
Right, because yeah. you have to go and still do every single one at a time.
Yes. So yeah, I would say the biggest orders I've ever done have been in the hundreds. And then like, yeah, once people ask me to do like a 500 run for them, I'm like, are you sure? Here's what I would recommend, but I can do this if you want me to.
Do your discs all, I call them discs, but they're not necessarily discs. Do your records all, or are they all playback at the same speed? Are they all 78s or 33s? Or
I can do it for three different speeds. I can do 33s, 45s, and 78s. Yeah. But I usually do 33 and a third simply because I want to fit as much content onto each record as right. possible. But yeah, I can do any of them.
Why don't you play something else? Give me another example of something here. I'll hand you the stack back.
Do you want to hear some? Let's see, some local local electronic artist, or you want to hear a California punk band?
California punk, local electronic. Mm-hmm. Those both sound good.
We'll play them both.
Yeah,
yeah. So here, I'll start with a local artist. This is a woman named Puma Shock. She is absolutely one of my favorite musicians. She has this amazing project that she's working on right now called High Score. And what it is that she takes a video game and she plays it on mute, okay? And then she imagines...
She plays it like she's got the controller.
Yes.
Okay.
And so she's playing the video game on mute and she imagines what she thinks that game sounds like. And so then she will write the music and basically replace it in her mind. So I have that here. This is from a video game called Golf Story, and this is what Puma Shock thinks that music would have sounded like if she would have unmuted her television.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Puma Shock, hire her for your next video game composition project. Those are fantastic.
Isn't that great? No, she's fantastic, both as a human being and as a musician. And yeah, that second track was called Hungry Hearts Diner. So that was the second game that was on that one where, yeah, so Golf Story and then Hungry Hearts Diner.
I have to imagine that that music was way more fantastic than the music that was in the golf video game.
I don't know, but
golf doesn't really strike me as having necessarily all that evocative of music.
You're dead right. And that's that to me is the fun of this too, is like anything you want, just do it. Just do it, you know? I love it. It's so much fun. Oh, but we were saying while the music was playing.
I was thinking about the difference between, and I think about this a bit in my own life, the difference between listening to a record or what it was like when really that was what there was to listen to, you know? I grew up in the era where there was CDs, you know, my first music was on CDs and some stuff on tape cassette too. Like I had a Walkman when I was a little kid,
right?
You know, and obviously now have a tremendous amount of digital things that I can just click on and you know, come instantly to my ears. Plenty of other things that I have to scrounge for too still. But, you know, we were listening to some old long Pink Floyd songs together, my wife and I, and just like, you know, don't skip to the next track. Just listen to the whole side. And then when it's done, you got to walk over and flip it over.
Yeah, yeah.
The experience of it, listening to it is different, I guess.
I think a big part of it is there is a feeling of commitment. It's you saying, I'm intentionally doing this. I am setting aside some time. I am physically standing up. I am moving this. I am dedicating my energy to this. And like you said, it makes it harder to skip. It makes it harder to ignore, you know? And I feel that way about streaming music in general. I mean, I'm by no means putting down anyone who likes streaming music. I know it is the main format for everyone these days. But personally, I've never liked streaming music because it feels too disposable for me to give it enough attention. So if I go to a store and I buy a record, I know that I have paid for this. I'm bringing it home. I'm putting it down on my record player. I'm playing it. And I give it that amount of attention. You know, I've had to make decisions. I've had to decide what record I wanted to buy. I've had to, and when I say record, I also mean CDs. I still buy CDs all the time too. And there's a commitment there that makes me give it as much attention and as much, I guess, dedication as it requires of me, as compared with when I stream something, it just kind of happens at me. And whether I do anything or not, it's just going to keep going or stopping or whatever. It means nothing.
You sort of just dip into that continuum.
Yeah, and which is fine. I'm not putting it down. I just know that for me personally, I pay more attention to an album and to music in general if I've made any kind of small commitment to it, any kind. You know, if I've just bought in a little bit, I'm paying attention.
In that relationship that we have with media, I think, has changed a lot in really the last 10 years or so. I mean, Netflix, Spotify, the other ones.
Exactly, every other one.
But like in the early days of digital music, or, you know, when the MP3 first came around, the iPod, it was still about having.
Yes.
Keeping.
Yes.
Archiving, you know, I own this thing. And now it's much more like, oh, I pay a service for, you know, I pay a fee for this service to maintain my music collection for me.
I don't like it.
He doesn't like it.
I don't like it at all. And
let me tell you what one of the pros of that is for me.
Oh, hit me.
Is that I have a kind of big personal library at home of all kinds of things that some of which I will never ever part with and some of which I don't know what to do with, but I can't part with, you know, tapes, films, videos, things that are family historically significant, things that I just haven't had the time to go through. I just got rid of every CD I owned.
Wow.
I've kept all my tapes. I kept all of my – there's two CDs that are on my desk right now that I don't know are in any other format. Like I don't know if they're online.
Right.
I could rip them and then have them in a – but but you have to maintain that file, so I have to know where the file lives.
Right,
as opposed to if it's on like a – but Spotify surely doesn't have everything.
Oh, and the thing that I hate most about Spotify is that it's in flux. That you may not notice it, but there are albums that you'll listen to one week, and then the next week you go back to listen to it again, and it's gone.
Right, they're working out that licensing. I'm sure it's very complicated for the people that are in the legal department at Spotify.
Absolutely. And so that's one of the saddest things to me. Like, I'll give you a perfect example that is movie-based, which is Pee-wee's Big Holiday. Did you ever see that movie?
Oh, gosh. I wanted to say yes immediately, but I can't remember anything about it.
That's this one where he is going to Joe Manganiello's
birthday
party.
Oh, it's the new one.
Yes.
I watched it. I watched it shortly after it came out.
Yes,
yeah.
And he loves like root beer barrel candy in it a lot and all that stuff. Anyway, there's a lot of
things. Certainly not as distinct
things.
In my memory as the original one from the 80s.
Oh, definitely. That one is king of the crop. That one's amazing. But I love that new one just because I love Paul Rubens.
No, it was very good, yeah.
And the thing about it is yes, I've had a Netflix, account for who knows how long. It's got to be like close to a decade at this point, you know. But what if I don't someday? What if they decide they want to take that movie off there? Then I can't watch this movie I love. Why? Because they say so? And in the old days, we're talking pre-VHS days, that was the way it was. And then we all got used to this world of, no, if I want to watch Who Framed Roger Rabbit, I can watch it whenever I want because I own that VHS.
Because I've taped it off the TV and was carefully paused it every time a commercial came on.
Yes. And so that being the case, the fact that the world's trying to take that away from us, I know that in some regards it's helpful. In some regards it is like this thing of like, oh, don't worry, we're going to save your shelf space. You don't need to be your own personal curator anymore. But I think there is an ulterior motive, which is money. And
is that ulterior? I mean, I think that that's clearly the motive behind, you know, the VHS days, mm-hmm. the Spotify days, everything in between, the things before.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just makes me a little sad that, like, I can't watch that Pee-wee Herman movie whenever I want. I can only watch it when I have access to Netflix, you know? And that's sad to me.
I do think something like I consume most of my new music. I mm-hmm. consume a lot of old music from, like, places like archive.org YouTube, but like Bandcamp.
Oh, totally. Oh, damn it. I love Bandcamp so much. It's the best music platform of the past 20 years, period.
I can stumble. I can just go click a couple of things, categories, and just stumble on random albums. Pick albums based on the cover that people put on there, which is not even a cover, really. I'm calling it a cover, but it's just an image that's sitting in a square on a page.
An album's avatar.
Yeah, exactly. But I can, in a way that I can't do in any other format. Like, I can't stumble. If you just click next video in YouTube, mm-hmm. you get stuff that you don't want to see and you can't unsee, can't unhear. Mm-hmm. In Bandcamp, I end up hearing things that I would never hear anywhere else.
Definitely.
And I do think that in some way that's, you know, is, you know, owes something to the digital revolution, this idea of, but there's the twofold thing on Bandcamp too, where it's like, hey, I've got my album streaming here and it's free and you can listen to it whenever you want. You could buy it and most of it goes directly to the artist, or I maybe have a thing that I put on tape cassette or on vinyl or some other. I've got a friend that does things on reel to reel.
Oh, that's so cool.
Handmade reel to reels.
That's great. But no, I think that's fantastic. And also, one of my favorite features about Bandcamp that you were just talking about, like the discoverability of Bandcamp, is if you go to the homepage, they'll have this thing down at the bottom showing in real time what people are buying. So like little things will like pop up, like just like little albums. Like this just was bought in Denmark for €8. This was just bought in Japan for this much, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if you just see this stream of albums passing by your eyes and you can just click on one and go, what's this? Click. And you just see it. And it just reminds me of being in a record store and seeing like the employee recommendations or seeing like...
Or just listening to the stuff they're playing on the speakers in there.
And it's just nice. Like that sense of discoverability, I think, is really valuable. And I love Bandcamp. I think they are... I know that they have a plenty of acclaim. I think they are perpetually underrated only because they deserve all the acclaim. they need to be number one.
And it's good for artists, too. I mean, I don't know exactly what the deal is, but the cut is better, as I understand, than something like Spotify.
No, my record label's on Bandcamp, and so I know exactly what the cut is.
Oh, yeah.
It's very little. It's very little. They take, like, pennies. It's nothing. Yeah. It's something you'll never even notice. Yeah.
And I like also, sometimes, like, you know, you're listening to, like, a Vaporwave album, for instance, and you're like, I don't know what part of the world this came from.
Yeah.
I can't tell. Is this Japanese?
Yeah.
Does it matter?
Mm-hmm. I have, in the past year, released two albums from two completely different bands that both claim falsely that they are from a small town in Greenland.
And you just don't know where they're from.
Oh, I know where – actually, I personally know where they're from because I worked with them both.
Oh, yeah.
But the fact that two completely separate bands, both on Bandcamp, claim that they are from the same town. I believe it's called Nuuk, and I can't spell it. But anyway, it's written in Greenlandic. But that's claimed they are from the same small town in Greenland makes me just so happy. And just it's just so strange to me. And they're very different genres. They're very different everything. One is like a pop punk band, and one is like a complete noise experimental band. And they both are like, yeah, that's where we're from. It's like, wow. No, you're not. But that's so cool. Like, because you could be from anywhere. You could be anyone.
You know, I think a lot of my, you know, personal music education for a long time was very much based on like English language music.
Yeah.
You know, music that was in characters that I can understand.
Totally.
And I feel like, you know, perhaps you had to do a little bit more work to get outside of that bubble before, and it's becoming easier to sort of see through to the other side.
Yeah, and I really hope I don't know people. I'm sure people do whatever it is people do, but I really hope people are taking advantage of that. I use my wife as a barometer for what is actually reaching the world, because like she's very good at having her pulse on what's happening in the world.
She's and a little more in touch, and you're just in the other room over your lathe.
I have
a similar relationship in my life.
and so quite often if there's something I'm really enjoying, I'll say to my wife, hey, do people actually know this, or is this just me? And she'll let me know if like no, this is a very popular thing, or no one's ever heard of this. And that happened last night. Speaking of foreign language music, have you ever listened to a woman named Rosalia?
Mm-mm.
She's best. She's a pop star out of Spain.
Yeah.
And I mean pop star straightforward. Like she's incredibly good at what she does, but it's just pop music, just plain straight pop music. But I was saying to my wife, I'm like, clearly she's super popular, right? And she's like, no. I'm like, why? She's like, she sings in Spanish. I'm like, what different? Oh, you know, and it made me so sad. It was just like, that's the barrier. I can never tell.
I sometimes feel, very often feel put upon by lyrics.
Mm, yes.
I also subscribe a bit to, I don't have to go too far in this, but like John Cage's, you know, school of thought that music doesn't have to be about expressing, you know, expressing anything really.
Yeah.
It can just be fun to listen to. It can just be, you can just listen.
Yes.
Without necessarily like having to have someone's feelings put upon you or their message. And I do feel like if I am going to listen to lyrical music with vocals, it's sometimes really nice when it's like, is that Icelandic?
Doesn't matter. Yeah. There was this, you know, the band Sigur Rós.
Of course.
Yeah, they had this one song.
Who sings not exclusively in Icelandic.
Right. Hopelandic.
Right.
Yes. Their made up language of Hopelandic. They released this one song. I'm going to say, it was a while ago now. Got to be at least a decade. They were like, it's our first English language song. Check it out. And they played it. And I listened to it. I was really excited. And I was like, sounds like the rest. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't matter.
I remember that. Yeah. I remember reading about that.
Yeah. It was during the gobbledygook like era.
Which I think was a great era.
I agree. Completely agree. Yeah.
I believe that Janzi married an American guy.
Yeah. Let's see. Their group.
His name is Alex.
Alex Summer, I want to say, because they have a band called Yonzi and Alex.
And they're very, very good. Yeah. Maybe a little bit more upbeat than Sigur Rós.
Yeah. Also, look into Alex Summer's brother is also an amazing musician
as well.
Yeah. But also good.
Yeah. We maybe got off track a little bit.
Definitely. Records.
So you cut all those Sigur Rós records on your... No, let me ask you, is business booming?
My business always has inquiries. Literally every single day I have a new email from somebody. But a lot of it is people just kind of exploring. A lot of people don't really know what's happening with both what I'm doing and just music writ large. So like, for example, I would say on a close to daily, I get an email from someone going, hey, will you make me a record? I'm like, yeah, sure, what you need? And they're like, well, I want this Eagles song on one side and I want this Madonna song on the other side. I'm like, no. Copyright. I can't do that for you. Of course not. You know, like...
Why would you want that exactly?
I've heard a couple of things. Yeah. One is if they own their own personal jukeboxes in their own homes.
Oh, okay. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. And then the other reason I have heard from DJs, where if they are a vinyl only DJ,
that makes sense,
and they want to keep that going.
But if you're a DJ, you should be able to shuffle your discs. Yes. I mean, but
and then there was one other reason. Oh, and then I think people who are literally just getting into vinyl for the first time and they're just curious. They know what they like, and maybe it's a gift for someone. It could be lots of reasons. But every time I obviously say no, because like no, the copyright law. That's very illegal.
You can't really be putting Madonna on it.
No, not unless your name
on a record and selling it.
Unless your name is Madonna. Yeah. I'm not putting Madonna on a record for you. I'm very, very sorry. So things like that come up a lot. I'll also get a lot of people that, again, because vinyl has had a resurgence, I'd say, in the past decade, you know?
Absolutely.
So a lot of people are wanting to just do something with it, but they don't really understand it. So like, for example, on a 7-inch record, I can put about 5 minutes on each side, 5 minutes of audio. So someone will be like, oh, hey, can I put this song on this record? And they'll send me like, let's say a 7-minute song. I'm like, oh, actually, no, we can't put this on a 7-inch. I can put this on a 10-inch or a 12-inch for you, but I can only put 5 minutes on a 7-inch record. And they're like, oh, well, can't we just make it fit? It's like, aw, like it's literally space. Yeah. It's like literally space and time. Like it's, we can't. We literally cannot.
I suppose if you didn't grow up with it, or you just really haven't thought about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You haven't thought about the literal record, the literal grooves, the 33 1/3 revolutions per minute. Like if you don't think about it as a. Because definitely I get a lot of kids too. Kids who are brand new to this world. And
which I think is so cool.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That makes me very, very happy.
Me too. Yeah.
And it's so great. Like one of my favorite things in the world to do is putting out an EP for a band where their entire EP fits on a 7-inch. That makes me so happy. Like young, like punk bands today.
Oh, yeah.
That makes me so happy. Where it's just like, oh, you kids, you're doing it. Good for you.
That's
you know?
Great.
And yeah. It's fun to...
People are having a... Millennials are tracking down turntables.
Exactly.
It's good. It's very good.
It is. And most people get it. I would say I only get angry people who are mad at me for not making hi-fi records maybe once a month.
But it's so easy to get hi-fi records.
Exactly. No, my stance is very, very simple. It's that if you want a hi-fi record, you can get it. And if you want something that sounds exactly like the digital file, you got the digital file. Like it goes back to that camera and painting metaphor.
Right.
It's like, I'm not doing that. I'm making something else. I'm making a side path, a side route. And you don't have to have it. You know what I mean? Like I'm not insisting that everyone listens to lo-fi mono records that were handmade. That'd be silly. But if you want it, I got it for you.
I want to right now. Why don't you play me the last one that you got queued up here?
You got it. Check out the label on this one. This is a band called Undercover Monsters, and this is their EP called Trash Friends. And
great names, guys.
They contacted me, and they're just like, the logo of the band is in this font. Can you write that on each of the records? I'm like, of course.
That's all you did. You just cut in the name in cursive.
Yeah, I just got my little etching tool, and one record at a time. Bzzz, bzz, 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 bzz. And it's fun.
That is certainly not something you can call just anyone to do for you.
No. But I like art. I like art for art's sake, and I like making things. And so if other people want to do those things, I'm here for them, you know? This is a band called Undercover Monsters, Trash Friends, and they make just, you know, some fun party pop punk kind of stuff. Oh, try to start from the beginning. It's fun.
Get some good Foley in here.
Yeah.
Bloody daddy, we like to party. We don't cause trouble. We don't bother nobody. But we're just some kids who rock the mic right. When we rock the mic right, we rock the mic right. Bloody daddy, we like to party. Don't cause trouble. We don't bother nobody. Cause we're just some kids who rock the mic right. When we rock the mic right.
body, we don't cause trouble, we don't bother nobody, cause we're just the kids who rock the mic right. When we rock the mic right, we rock the mic right. La-di-da-di, we like to party, we don't cause trouble, we don't bother nobody, cause we're just the kids who rock the mic right. When we rock the mic right, we rock the mic right.
Oh, yeah. So you could probably get a lot of punk songs on a 12-inch, yeah?
Oh, yeah, yeah. A lot of times I've done a lot of single-sided punk 12-inch EPs. There's been a lot of that.
Yeah.
And it's fun. It's a lot of fun. I mean, like, if art is... Actually, this is a big thing in my life in general. I really, really, really am happy that becoming a musician is no longer a get-rich-quick scheme. Because you remember, like, back in, I'm going to say, the late 90s into the early 2000s, probably even longer ago, people wanted to become, quote-unquote, rock stars or pop stars or musicians in general because it was a get-rich-quick scheme. It was like, oh, that's how I'll make a lot of money, is I'll become a musician.
That sort of ties in timeline-wise with, like, a particular kind of commodification of artists.
Yes.
You think of, like, the boy band era, that sort of thing.
And not too long after that, that's when Napster kicked in and all these other things kicked in, which made it not so easy to make money from music. And so a lot of people who were only in it for the money, they went away. And I love that because it means that anyone who's still doing it, they do it because they love it. And those are the best people in the world.
Right. I agree. Seth, tell the listening public where they can find more about your record label.
I would say the best place to find me is you go to hauntedbirthday.com. That's the main place. And then you can go from there to find the social media sites, et cetera, et cetera. Actually, I suppose since we're talking so much about what these things look like, a really good place to go would be to my Instagram page, which would be @hauntedbirthday.
And there's a great couple of videos that you've done of this process, because describing it and seeing it are definitely different things. So I will I will include a link to that in an easy to find place.
Because I mean, like the interesting thing about this process, like I've been saying, is a lot of it's education, like just letting people know what it is that I'm even doing, you know? And so that's why I made these videos.
Well, I have learned a lot today about exactly how this works, though I surely have a lot more questions. I think most of my questions might be the kind that would bore people.
That's understandable, but...
I want to talk more about that curve.
Off mic, you and I can talk all day about all the really boring stuff.
Yes.
About, like, groove depth and the RIAA curve.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, think about, like, the depth of sound. That is the difference between a traditional, like, 180-gram record and me just pushing a ruby as hard as I can into a piece of plastic. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, the depth of sound you can get from a quote-unquote real record is so much deeper. But that's that trade-off. It's that, well, do you have 300 fans and a whole bunch of money? Or do you need two copies and you can do whatever you want? And it's a trade-off. You do whatever you want to do.
You got one more thing to play us out here?
Maybe.
A giant stack of handmade records.
Yeah, it all depends on who I have the rights from. Let's see here. Oh, well, no.
I'll go ahead and say thanks a lot for coming in and doing this.
Absolutely. And thank you to the artists also that I contacted to say, hey, do you mind if we play your music on the show today? Thank you to them for allowing us to play their music publicly. That's very nice of them.
Thanks, artists.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thanks to Elias Mason and June York, Puma Shock, and Undercover Monsters for letting us play their music. The eyes, ears, hands, and brain behind Haunted Birthday Records is Seth Nicholas Johnson. See this process in action and get your own record produced at hauntedbirthday.com. And follow up on everything you heard here at ephemeral.show. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.